When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of the 1871 podcast. It's myself, Johnny Hunt, presenting this evening. And our guest is ex-Reading goalkeeper, Steve Mortone. And apologies in advance. We have a co-host, my daughter, Edie Rose, maybe join us at some stages. But she talks more sense than me, so let's stick with it. Steve, good evening. Welcome. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And thanks for having me on the show, mate.
Pleasure. So going back, Steve, back to the good old days, how did the move to Reading come about in 97? You were at West Ham.
Yeah, I was at West Ham. I just had a little bit of a loan stint, probably a few months before. I actually had a loan stint with Crewe Alexandra.
Yeah.
And I was called back early because at the time, Ludo McCosker was the goalkeeper at West Ham and he'd got injured. So I was meant to stay at Crewe for about 3 months and ended up staying a week. I played three games there in a week and got called back and had a taste of first team football. Knew probably my future wasn't with West Ham. It probably wasn't going to be, you know, knocking Ludo off the number one spot. You know, he's a legend of the game and legend at West Ham. So I approached my agent, who was Barry Stiltman, and just said to him, look, you know, I need to just play more games and put myself out there. I'd done quite well, both for West Ham and for Crewe. So at the time, Bobby Mihailov was the keeper. He'd just done his knee. Silky said to me, look, the guys are going to come down from Reading and watch one of your reserve games, you know. So I remember he said, look, they need a keeper who's commanding, who talks a lot, who organises. He goes, and I don't know if you've ever met Silky or heard Silky talk, he's very, you know, East Londoner. He goes, listen, whatever you do, just scream. Mate, I was screaming it. You know, I was telling the left back to tuck in. The left back wasn't even there. You know, he was up the field. So I was just screaming for the sake of screaming. And it obviously worked because, you know, they took me on loan. And then from there, I, you know, played some games on loan and then ended up signing.
And that was it. I remember that season when you came in, like, you know, you helped keep us up under Jimmy Quinn, Mick Gooding, wasn't it? How was that when you came into the change room, Reading? Did you know anyone or did you have any kind of contacts there?
No, I only knew Andy Bunnell just from, you know, being Australian. I didn't really know him personally, but you know, to have a familiar face and someone that I'd met before and spoken to before and knew was very good for me to come in. But you know, as a footballer, especially, you know, and I was traveling around, you know, I played in Italy when I was 16 and you get used to going into change rooms and sort of sitting back and sussing out who the alpha males are and working out, you know, where you, where you sort of sit amongst the core group. But I didn't know anyone. Nobody really knew me. And the good thing was that the games just started straight away, you know, thick and fast. Change rooms are a really interesting dynamic because I've been in change rooms like West Ham where, you know, I was a first team. I was sitting on the bench for almost a season. But until I played my first game, I was never really respected by the boys. You know, you're always sort of on the outer. So coming from a Premier League team down to a Championship team probably made it easier for that sort of respect. But, you know, being able to play straight away was always a benefit. And you get, you know, people get around you, especially when you do reasonably well as well. People get around you a little bit more and are accepting. So that was
good. What was your impressions of Elm Park? I know, you know, West Ham's old ground's a bit similar, but they're probably a little bit of an upgrade. What did you think of the place?
Yeah, look, I don't know. It doesn't stick in my mind that, and it was a long time ago, by the way, but it doesn't stick in my mind that it was a big culture shock. I'll tell you what sticks in my mind more was going on loan to Crewe. I mean, that was an eye-opener, you know? Yeah. So I probably had a little bit of a baptism of fire there and then was probably used to expecting the worst because when I went up to Crewe, that happened while I was travelling with the first team. We were playing Leeds away. And the night before the Leeds game, the management pulled me in and said, look, you've got a chance to go on loan. We really want to see you play. You're going to sit on the bench for us this tomorrow, and then you're straight up to Crewe. You're playing Sunday. And this is like a Saturday. So Friday night, ready to play Saturday, straight up there Sunday. And it happened that quick that the only hotel that had any availability in Crewe was only like a broom cupboard, I reckon they had, you know. So they stuck me in this thing. The bed was lumpy. It had no windows. I swear it was like, it must have been like a storage cupboard. They just threw a fold away bed in there, you know. And that was a bit of a culture shock. So coming to Elm Park, it wasn't too bad. And the atmosphere was quality, you know. Like, you didn't need a lot of people there to have a good atmosphere.
No.
And the first game we played was against Southend at home, and I think we won 2-1 or 3-1, I can't remember. Jukesy scored an unbelievable goal. But so to have a win, you know, it was probably only 8,000-9,000 people, but it was good atmosphere, and I was just happy playing, you know.
Yeah, I was under just that tin roof.
Under that tin roof, yeah. So
you had some quality players there, didn't you, alongside you in that team, even though we were struggling. We had, like, the players from the playoff that were still in the squad, leaders.
Yeah.
Who was the sort of standout characters in that team?
Stuart Lovell was, he wasn't like a standout character, but he was sort of a solid, you know, solid guy in the change rooms and, you know, fairly stable. And it just seemed to revolve around him, you know, like, not that it was sort of one of the leaders in there. He actually took a backward step, but he seemed to just be involved in everything on and off the field. Parky was unbelievable. He was straight away, you know, come over, and obviously he was the captain, you know, come introduce himself and made me feel welcome.
Yeah.
And then you had like Michael Mika. Was it Michael Mika? Like I said, you know, whenever I get in the change rooms, new crowd, I even do it now when I'm coaching and stuff, but you kind of sit back and you see who the characters are, who's taking the piss out of who or whatever. And he was definitely amongst it. He was always looking for an angle to wind someone up, you know. So I knew to stay clear of him for a little bit until I got used to him. But Trevor Morley was there.
Class player.
In the first year. Yeah. James Lambert, great player, great potential, you know, probably, you know, too good a player, too young. And he'd only just come back from Monaco, I think it was. So he was definitely a good player. And if you asked him, he told you he was a good player.
I think he still does.
He still does, yeah. I actually really liked him and I got on well with him. But I saw a potential in him that probably, if he had have sort of concentrated on his own performance instead of worrying about everyone else, probably could have done a lot more. But I don't know if you remember that goal he scored against Forest. That was actually my last game.
Oh, wow.
He had that ability, you know. So, you know, and then there was Paul Holsgrove was there as well. And Jooksy was in there, but then he left almost straight away. He went up to Wolves. Keith McPherson. So Jooksy and Keith McPherson I just caught up with just recently as well.
Oh,
I was in the UK. Yeah, and had a laugh with them and a reminisce. So it was a really good change room. Some good experienced players, and some good youngsters as well coming through as well. Yeah.
And then like that first season, you had Quinny and Green in charge, didn't you? How were they to work under as a player? You had different guys on that coming through. You know, on the and then they had Quinny.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, look, it was an interesting dynamic, I suppose, because being player managers or player coaches, I think it's always a tough job to balance the two. And I've experienced it here in Australia where one of my good mates, Kevin Muscat, was a player at Melbourne Victory when I was coaching, and then he became manager. And you have to change. You have to separate yourself from being one of the leaders of the boys to being the manager.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure that their task was, and I didn't know them before when they were just players, but I'm sure their task was, you know, immensely difficult for that point of view.
Yeah.
But I remember them being very professional, very, very good at what they were doing, and you know, not really remember hearing any real murmurs of issues because they were player managers. So I think that, you know, I thought they did a good job. You know, they were probably unlucky. You know, in hindsight, if you think about who took over from them, you know, did they do a better job, worse job? I don't know. I mean, we ended up getting relegated the following year, so probably they did a worse job. But
yeah, Terry the taxi, wasn't it? Terry Bullivant.
Terry Bullivant, yeah.
Yeah. What was he like to work under? I mean, he came in, didn't he, as a fresh and sort of new enough and coming manager?
No, it was. I actually made my West Ham debut against Terry and Barnett in a cup game. So he just struck me as a very nervous guy. And I can actually remember in a team talk, he almost lost his train of thought and it just kind of, you know, bamboozled him and he couldn't sort of get back on track. And, you know, but he knew his stuff. I just don't know whether he was, you know, manager material, that's all.
Yeah. It's a big step up.
Probably what led him down. Yeah, I think so. I mean, he did well at Barnett. He was at Barnett right before he came to us. And I think he did reasonably well there, but you know, Reading at the time, I suppose, Reading was a big jump from Barnett. I mean, two years before, I suppose, the club was almost at the top level, and Barnett, I think, were in the old third division or whatever it was, the League Two, and a small club, but. He had experience around him. I mean, Alan Pardew wasn't an experienced manager, but he'd been around, you know, played at big clubs and the highest level. And I can't remember the other assistant's name, but I think he spent some time in Spain, didn't he, with...
You're trying to think who it was, actually. Mine's got a blank.
Yeah, if you say his name, I remember. I just can't remember. He was an older guy, but, you know, like they had some experience, but I just don't think... You know, Terry Bullivant had, had that character to be a manager.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think he's very knowledgeable. He knew the game, but I just don't know if he had that character, you know.
So we had Linvoy Primus on with us a while back, and I think he came in under Terry, didn't he?
He did,
Carlos Saba, and like there were two decent signings, weren't they? But it just didn't, that season just, it kind of faded away, a bit like Reading's season just gone, doesn't it?
This year, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't think we ever really, and we had what's his name come in as well in the middle of the park, Ray Houghton.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
was there as well. Yeah, yeah. Look, I don't remember us being terrible really in any games. We just, I don't know, just I suppose didn't really win a lot. I mean, I got injured after I don't know how many games. I think it was November, December. I think I remember injuring my knee at training, and I sort of just tweaked it, and I kind of played for about 4 weeks with a sore knee, and eventually said, you know, I said to the medical staff, you know, it keeps swelling up a little bit. What's going on? We got scans, and that's when they discovered that I tore my cartilage, and the night that they told me was the night before we were playing, it was either Stoke or someone like that, and I said, oh look, I've played on for 3 or 4 weeks with this bit of pain, I'll just keep playing, and yeah, you know, it should be all right. End of the season, we'll do something about it. The next day in the warm up, it locked up on me, I couldn't move.
I remember that. I remember that game. Yeah,
that Port Vale it was.
Yeah,
away at Port Vale. Yeah.
Like so, after that, Steve, did you play again for us? Because you know you went to the Majeski, didn't you? You were part of the squad for.
I was in the squad. I sat on the bench a few times, but I never played again. And in fact, like I was saying to you, the week before was the televised game against Nottingham Forest, where we lost 3-1, I think it was, or 2-1, or 3-3.
3-3 it was in the end, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a 3-3.
Yeah.
I have to remember what's his name, Stone Messon, an absolute sitter.
Yeah, that's right, but,
yeah. But see, although I had a little bit of pain in my knee, that game, it didn't, my knee just never fazed me, but I remember it just swelled up a bit the next, sort of that Monday, and I went and got checked out or that weekend, and we had an away game at Port Vale, and that's where I remember coming out for a cross in the warm-up, and my knee just, the cartilage must have just got caught in the wrong place and just locked up, and I actually never really recovered. Then after that, I kept tearing it, then they operated on it, and then I wanted to come back to Australia because there was a surgeon in Australia who was sort of a leading surgeon in knees, and I couldn't because of the insurance reasons, and then I ended up coming to Australia to do my rehab, and he just looked at my knee and said it's not, that they've tightened it up, but it hasn't worked, and got it redone virtually straight away. So I had like two reconstructions in the space of 3 months.
How does that impact on your mental health, Steve? Something like that, you know, as a you know young player, and you're being told that you know that sort of size operation.
Yeah, look, mental health was never really talked about, so I just got on with it.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like. How can I say it? Every time I'd actually tore my cartilage. I had a reconstruction back in 1990, so like 10 years before almost, right? And it was almost like, okay, right, I'm determined just to get back stronger than ever. Like I never thought about, how it's going to affect my mentally, how it's going to affect me or whatever. And there were probably days where I was gutted, depressed. And in fact, actually at the time, right, I had there was an offer come in for me from two offers, one from Wimbledon, one from Coventry, and the club said no, he's not for sale, and you know I said the usual thing, and I loved it. I loved it at Reading. Don't get me wrong, but you know when the Premier League club comes in for you and they're bidding over £1.5 million or whatever it was at the time, you know you kind of think, oh, I want to try and get back into the Premiership, you know, so. I remember talking with my agent about it. And he said, look, you know, we think it's going to, you know, it could happen. They're really interested. Both clubs are really interested. It was Wimbledon and Coventry. And I had had a really good season, right, and started off really well. And I remember my agent saying to me, just sit tight and I'll let you know. And then that the following week I got injured. He goes, don't worry, you know, just get over your injury and we'll see what happens. And you know, maybe we'll negotiate again with Reading if you don't want to leave, whatever. And I just never recovered. So that probably, affected me a little bit, thinking I've missed that opportunity. Yeah. Hopefully there'll be another one around the corner. If it's not with Reading, it'll be someone else or whatever. And it just never happened. And you just, I probably never thought about the end because I was always determined to keep going. And even, you know, I ended up leaving Reading and I went up to Wolverhampton and I had a 6 month stint there. I had about 4 months at Crystal Palace and I ended up at Gillingham and never really got going at any of the clubs because I probably needed another 6 months of rehab.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my contract had run out. Tommy Burns had come in. They wouldn't extend my contract. They'd only give me a week to week, you know. And as a footballer, week to week, you're going, man, I got bills to pay. You know, and where Wolves had given me a 6 month contract, and I thought, well, that, you know, that's better than week to week, and maybe I can build on it. But I was just never right again, you know.
Yeah.
Played a bit of non-league, but it just, it's hard enough to be a footballer as it is, let alone, I think the last operation that I had was my seventh in the year and a half.
Wow.
On the same knee, yeah. And, you know, so it's hard enough trying to, I suppose, trying to be a footballer, you know, with a fit, able body, let alone trying to do it with three reconstructions and then probably another eight operations under your belt, you know.
Jeez.
But I gave it a go. I'm playing for it now. I walk around with a bit of a limp, but, you know, I'll get
I was going to ask you, I was going to say, 20-odd years later, do you still have an impact on you? There you go. Right? Like it must.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, unfortunately, it does. I'm actually trying to get some stuff sorted out. But, you know, look, I would never, you know, people go, oh, man, look, you know, look what you've done. I would never give it up. If I knew this was the outcome and I had to start again, I'd start again and do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
You know? So I had the time of my life, mate. You know, like I was a kid who grew up on a country farm, you know, in the outback of Australia. And to say that I've walked away with playing in one of the best leagues in the world,
yeah.
You know, having a career that spanned over 17 years as a professional, and then following that coaching for, you know, 10, 12 years as a pro. Like, I feel fortunate that I was given these opportunities, but I also worked pretty hard for it as well, you know.
Yeah. And that, on the A League, it's in the finals at the minute there. How the A League's progressed over the years? Like, you know, I was over there 2005 and watched it, how it started off, and so when you were coaching and watching Grant Bremner run around for the victory, you know, and all the ex Reading connections that were going on at the time. Where do you think it is now? Where it's going for the future?
It's definitely plateaued. And it's unfortunate because it kind of had a bit of a peak in the 70s and 80s and then sort of died down a little bit. And then when the A-League come in, I came back from the UK the year after the A-League was formed and I had a lot of skepticism. I thought it's going to just fall on its ass again. But then all of a sudden, we, you know, Victory started getting some success. There was only one team in Melbourne, and we're getting crowds of 20, 30,000, you know. And then all of a sudden, we had this big blockbuster game against Sydney. We had 50-odd thousand people at a game, and I'm going, I can't believe this is Australian football. You know, this is unbelievable. And it hit its peak, and then the Football Australia and the Australian government bid for the World Cup, right? So they bid for either Russia or Qatar. And the debacle that happened with that, I think they just got really gun-shy. And I think they were hanging their hats on hosting a World Cup, and that's the ultimate goal. And that's why we're driving this football league and we're spending all this money. And they had a big backer who was this guy who set up Westfield Shopping Centres, who I think you got Westfield in the UK. Yeah. And he had a big passion, and he was actually involved in the 70s setting up the old National League as well. And he kind of, you know, took a backward step. But they all got burnt from bidding for these World Cups, and both financially and I think emotionally. And what I noticed, whether it's just me noticing it as a coincidence or whether it actually was the case, I don't know. But I just noticed that, you know, the foot got taken off the pedal. And there wasn't as much marketing in the local game. We weren't attracting as many, you know, bigger named marquee players. And it's just slowly dying a slow death, you know. It's a shame, really, but, you know, it's just seems to be really, really at an interesting point, a little bit of a crossroads, you know. I hope it doesn't go, you know, down the road of sort of falling over, but they need to do something.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. I, the only thing I can think is that we don't get a lot of government support, and that's really what we need.
Yeah, I see, because you see Andy Bunnell's at the Central Coast Mariners now, isn't he? He's got a role there.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's
I didn't delighted. Know, yeah.
Yeah, he's, I think, yeah. I don't know what he's doing there, but so they've done very well this season. But I saw you were back in Reading a little while back for a game. How was that for you? When was the last time you were back before that?
Yeah. So I came back in 2015 with my whole family, and I managed to get to a game. And that was when Yap Stamp just took over. It was his first game of the season, actually.
Yeah.
That was great. And then my son, who's 14 now, he's loving his football. He's a keeper as well. He's only just started being a keeper. And
brainwashed him,
and
isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I say to everyone, I never pushed him, but, you know, when he was about 2 or 3 months old, he used to have the iPad in front of him watching goalkeeper clips. So it's probably subconsciously it was in there, you know. And he used to hang out with me when he was, you know, when he was a little fellow, and you know, at training and stuff when I was coaching at Victory. So, and whenever we had a bit of spare time, I'd sort of, you know, kick a few balls at him and that. So he was loved it. But like all kids, he wanted to be a striker. But now he's become a keeper, and he's doing really well, actually. So he's playing in sort of the higher level of junior football here in Melbourne. And he also got involved in this touring group that's associated with West Ham. So we had 2 weeks over in the UK at the start of April, where he played some games and trained. And we went and watched some games. And one of the games was that tour group had organised was going to watch QPR play somebody, I can't remember who it was now. And I noticed that Reading were playing Burnley at home. So, you know, we sort of split from the group. And
always,
Ronnie
always
Grant...
Always just the fake hoops.
Yeah. No, that's right, the fake hoops. So Ronnie Grant got in touch with me, and he runs the ex-players association. And he said, look, we'd love for you to come to the game and, you know, bring your son along. And he goes, you can go and, you know, we'll get you up in a director's box, but if you don't mind having a Q&A in one of the rooms or whatever. So I said, yeah, I loved it. And it was a great day. My boy walked away going, oh, today was the best day ever, you know.
Oh, wow.
And we actually went and watched Man City and Bayern Munich when we're up in Manchester. And I thought that was the best day. But he goes, no, today's the best day, you know. Like, and it was great because Ron actually took my boy aside and sort of didn't show him around the stadium, but sort of took him outside and said, you know, your dad, this is where your dad played, and this is what we thought of him when he was there. So he kind of got a bit of an insight.
Oh, wow.
It's not just dad telling him how good I was. You
yeah,
know,
somebody else actually could say it as well.
yeah. So, and he kind of saw a club like Reading, who probably from a distance you think, ah, they're just, you know, they're just a whatever. But going into the Majestic, still impressive stadium.
Yeah.
And you know, he goes, oh, Dad, this is fancy. We're in the director's box and having lunch. He goes, this is really fancy because we've got some big plates but little food, you know. So he loves it. And it was great. It was great for me to catch up with a lot of different people I hadn't seen for a long time. And then I managed to have a drink with Jukesy and Keith McPherson as well, which is good. Because I think Keith's son's at Reading.
Oh, wow.
In their 15s, yeah. So,
is he a defender like his dad or as well?
No, nah, he's not. I don't think he's a defender, no. No, but it was good. It was good because, you know, I spent a lot of time in Reading. Even after I'd finished playing, I sort of stuck around for a couple of years and was involved in a couple of different business ventures. And to go back and catch up with some friends who I still keep in touch with now was really good. You know, enjoyed it, yeah.
And what did you make of on the pitch? I know that game was a decent game for Noel Hunt, but you know, the relegation. What have you made of Reading's troubles over the last few years? Have you been following?
Yeah, I have been following. You know, sometimes it's hard to get really into the nitty gritty of what's going on. I sort of get on the social media side of things. I sort of catch up with some news, but that's more, you know, fans' views and stuff like that. Yeah. But I don't know the exact ins and outs, but I know they were punished by the financial fair play rules. Which in the end I think cost them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when that sort of stuff happens, even though you may be sort of mid-table struggling, I know what it's like when you're down the bottom. You seem to get sucked down even harder, you know, and nothing goes right for you. Whereas if they were in a sort of a safer place, maybe the rubber of the green kind of changes a little bit for you.
Every game went against us at the end. We went, oh please, can that team beat that team? Nope. No, you just went, not to be, and not to run out.
No, that's right. And I think Noel, I remember in that game, Noel and his crew did really well, and I thought that they really were positive and really gave it to a good team like Burnley, who play good football, which is a really strange thing to say when you're referencing Burnley, but they, you know, they've got a decent manager, but I thought they played well. But you know, and then, it was just, I don't know, they were just unlucky in the end, I think. And hopefully they can regroup and bounce back up straight away and live to fight another day, because they're certainly viewed differently, I think, after their stint in the EPL. They're viewed as one of the bigger clubs in the championships, whereas I think prior to that, they were always probably seen as a small fish hanging in there in the championship, you know?
Yeah.
So it'd be good to see them back up there, but, you know.
It's a big challenge, isn't it? Like, so the last time was when you were at Reading, we got relegated to League One, as it is now, isn't it? Yeah. So like, it kind of gone full circle, wasn't it? Because the way the club went after, you know, sort of the move to the Majewski and the getting to the Premier League, and now it's almost like a start again, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know. Tottenham's going through it at the moment. I think whenever there's instability, off the field, it just seems to, you just can't seem to avoid it on the field, you know, like obviously with the financial fair play and the owners and, you know, obviously I don't know exactly all the stories, but I was hearing rumours that, you know, things weren't right and previous owners and, I even heard the mention of Russians, which I never knew about. And,
you know, so that's it when it starts to go wrong.
Yeah, you know, I've been involved even here in Australia at a club where the at board level there's a bit of instability, and it just seems to push over onto the field, even though you might never even see them day to day. But when you've got a board and a director and a chairman who's stable and functional, and like probably what Majewski was like when he was bringing everyone in and holding everything together, it just seems to, success seems to almost follow that, you know. But then it's vice versa as well, you know.
Yeah, I think the clubs, the embargoes and, not being able to do proper transfers, and it's just been, you know, we've hung around for the last few years, managed to stay up, and then you just kind of, you feel like it's kind of run out of luck time, and now we're at, but that's football, isn't it?
No, that's right. That is football, and that's the beauty of the whole, setup in English football. You know, like in Australia, we don't have promotion relegation because there's not enough money. There's not enough clubs who financially could handle it. You know, you go to play an away game, and it costs you an absolute fortune. You got to fly, 25 players halfway across the country, stay two nights, like clubs couldn't get promoted and then try and sustain that. So you get a level of falseness in games because clubs are can't get into the top part of the to get into Champions League or win cup games and things like that. So then in the end they're just fielding kids and it just becomes crap. So I think the excitement of promotion relegation is what makes our game the beautiful game right all over the world. And sometimes, it's not a bad stabilizer where it kind of, you know, everyone sort of goes, okay, all right, now we need one. Let's see, what are we now really got to do to get back up there?
Yeah.
Because like you're saying, you're kind of hanging around, it's a little bit false. Maybe planning with, you know, in the back room of the offices wasn't getting done the right way because they were just in survival mode, and that maybe now they can sort of, you know, you've seen it many times where clubs get relegated, then relegated again, and then it takes them a couple of years, and then they come back and they're doing better than ever, you know.
Momentum, isn't it? It's a lot
to these
things. What's your life like now, Steve? Coming sort of full circle, what are you up to these days?
Yeah, look, I consider myself as a career coach, right? So I coach full time. I was coaching at Victory. I was running my own academy and getting involved in new stuff. And I've got three kids, right? So I've got twins who are 14 and a 12-year-old. And what I found was, like I said to you, in an away game, we would travel. You know, I'd leave the house at 6 a.m. on a Friday. I wouldn't get home till midnight on a Sunday after, you know, for an away game. And then by the time you get back to work, and I was hardly seeing the kids, right? And then when my kids started getting involved in sport, my son in football, my daughter's in basketball and swimming and all that, I was just missing everything, you know. And I spent 10 years at Victory, had some success. And I've always been a sort of not worried about trying to try different things, you know. I'm a bit of an entrepreneur. I do a bit of property. I've got businesses. And so I thought, you know, I want to try and dedicate some time to my kids, just like my dad did for me and help me, you know, with my career. So I left the professional coaching and I set up a business doing apparel. So I now supply apparel to both professional and semi-professional and amateur sporting clubs, mainly football, but you know, I do some volleyball, basketball. I had the contract for the national team for volleyball for about 4 years, and then you know, like COVID come in and destroyed everything for us, and it kind of forced me to change a little bit. So my business also now does workwear, corporate wear, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I dabble in a lot of different things. So, you know,
enjoying life.
Doing a bit of enjoying life. But in saying that, my son went to a club, and they're an amateur club, but they're sort of at that higher level of state competition here. They call it the Nationals Premier League. And I went there as a dad. I said to him, mate, I'm not getting involved. You go there, trial. I don't want them to see me or, you know, I don't want an influence at all. And he got a spot in the team there, and they lost their academy director, and I just saw it was starting to, you know, go pear shaped. So I put my hand up to help as academy director, and you know, I've gone from that. That's why I said 10 o'clock is great, because I had a coaches meeting tonight. Now I'm working every day after my own work. I go there and, you know, I run the club with all the coaching and put the programs together, and I'm really enjoying. I must admit, I'm really enjoying it. It's just that, you know, it just means I've got to sacrifice a couple of other things. But so I'm back into coaching. For I only really didn't coach for maybe a year, so I'm back into coaching now. Enjoying it. And
lastly, just one. What was your fondest memory looking back at your time at Reading? What would be the one thing for you?
Man, walking out on a sunny day, pre-season against Chelsea. That you know, like, there was probably 17,000 people there. The place was rocking. I just remember it as a beautiful day. And it was just, it was like, it gave me a warmth that maybe gave me, that day probably made me connect with the Reading Football Club.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was Elm Park. It was what it was.
Yeah, there I was there.
A level. Sorry?
I was there at that game. I remember that one.
Yeah, you remember it. I don't know. I just remember looking over as we walked out to the left, as we walked out of the tunnel to the left, and I can't remember what they used to call that side, but that, you know, behind the goals, it was standing room only. It was packed. The Tyler said, and the singing and everything. It was just a buzz, and it was almost like it was because it was only a year or maybe a bit longer than a year where Reading nearly got promoted, right? It was almost like this is what it would have been like if we were in the, you know, like Chelsea were a big team, yeah, some big players as well. And I don't know, that's if I think about a fond memory, like that day just sticks out in my mind. It's like a day I'll never forget. Also because, you know, I have an Italian background, so there was some Italian, big Italian players in that team.
Zola was playing, wasn't he?
Zola scored 2 goals.
But
I'm actually proud to mention that because he scored against far better keepers than me, so I'm okay with that, you know. But, you know, Di Matteo was playing, you know, national team, Zola, Viali.
Wow.
And these guys here, you know, I kind of idolised as Italian national team players, and I'm on the same path as them. But it's just, you know, like it's the whole thing of the town buzzing. I remember walking out, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was just a beautiful day, and it was just a great atmosphere as well, you know. So, and I know it just felt like everyone enjoyed it. And I don't know whether it was that game, but I ended up going across the road to the pub. What was it called? The
Spread Eagle?
Spread Eagle or something.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Spread Eagle there.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I went after the game, went in and had a drink, and it was brilliant. Like, it was just, you know, like I kind of felt... It made me almost feel like I was at home, you know?
Oh,
so that's probably my fondest memory. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, what a great way to finish up. Steve, thanks so much for your time. Yeah. I know it's late over there for you and you probably need to get to bed. But it's been a pleasure.
No, now I've got some sessions I've got to plan for tomorrow, mate. So I'm still working, mate. No, all good. Hey, I really enjoyed it. And sorry, I remember I was meant to be on a while back and I missed it and whatever, but I really appreciate the chance to get on and have a chat and it's probably great that it's followed on from my recent visit as well, you know?
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks so much for your time, Stephen. Just to let folks know, this episode will be out this evening on the YouTube channel, as we have now, and also on the Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. So thanks again, Steve, and have a good day, everyone. Cheers.
No problem. Go the Royals.
Cheers, Steve. You're a star, mate. Thanks so much again.
Really nice
speaking to you again.
Well, you too. All the best.
Take care, Steve. Bye, mate. Bye-bye.
Cheers, mate. Bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.